Welcome to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Every week, you'll find us right here on WEAA as we follow the stories that affect the land and the communities of Delmarva. Today, we'll speak with some of the newly elected leaders from Delmarva about their plans, ideas, and thoughts about the future of this peninsula. First, we'll speak with Megan Cook and Kelly Malone, both newly elected members of the Easton Town Council. Then, in the second half of the show, we're joined by the Reverend Craig Mathias, who was just installed as a county commissioner in Somerset County. He's the first African-American to hold office in a countywide position in the 344-year-old history of that county. This is Mark Steiner for On Delmarva. We are in Easton, Maryland, and we are in the town council in the chambers where they have the town meetings. And we are meeting with two of the town council people today. We'll meet with more later. And we're meeting with them after a meeting with some others here on the shore who talked about rising leaders, and we try to meet them across the shore one by one, two by two, four by four, however it works. And we're here this morning with Megan Cook, who is the Easton Town Councilwoman from Ward Number 4, and Kelly Malone from Ward 1. And pleasure to meet you all. Thank you for welcoming us to the Town Council.
Good morning. Our pleasure.
When did you first get elected? This is your first term?
This is my first term. I've been here a year and a half so far.
So why did you run?
Why did I run? I moved here about 7 years ago with my husband, and at the time I had one child, and I have three. And
congratulations.
Thank you. So our family grew, and a few years ago I helped, along with a large number of volunteers, build a park at Idlewild Park, which was a community build. It took us about 9 months. We raised over $300,000 and built a great park for the community. And with that, that kind of jump-started me into meeting with the town, dealing with the town, and it got me interested in what else I could help, you know, with the town. And so after the park finished, elections were coming up in about a year and a half later, and I thought about it and decided to throw my hat into the ring for Ward 4 because I felt that I had the time and the energy to help the community beyond just the four walls of my home. So that's how I got involved.
And this is your second term?
No, actually, I was elected in January 2009. It was a special election. My predecessor, Maureen Scott Taylor, resigned from the council to take a job with the town. She's now our town's economic director. And so an opening was available.
So why did you run?
Well, that's a good question. At the time, my son had just graduated from high school and was off to college, and I was considering getting my graduate degree. So I was looking around for something to do, what's next, and had actually no intention or aspiration to run for political office until Maureen stepped down and people began to approach me. After honestly kind of laughing out loud the first couple of times someone suggested that I run, I thought maybe I should consider this and take this seriously. And so I thought about it, and I looked around, and I thought I'm only going to run for office if I can identify clear ways that I can make a difference in my community. Uh-huh. So I started talking to people, and clearly there were concrete projects that I felt that I could make a difference in. So I said yes, and here I am.
So tell me about the districts you represent for a moment.
I'm Ward 4. I'm primarily a minority district. I run basically from 50 to the bypass. Takes up a lot of downtown and over towards the YMCA. So I have a primarily African-American and Hispanic district.
Majority. and you won.
And I won.
I'm wondering, as people who represent new leadership in the Eastern Shore on Delmarva, what you see are the major issues that you're gonna that are faced here?
I think a couple of the big ones for Easton is growth. The size of our community is growing significantly. We have seen a lull more recently, but historically we have seen, you know, roughly 3% growth, which a lot of the reasons people move to Easton is for the small town feel. And over time, if this growth pattern continues without some kind of planning for it, our town can turn into any community across the states. So I think that's one of the big issues that our town faces. And also the economy is hitting significantly, making an impact in our community, as it is every other community. But keeping our downtown viable, keeping the shops open, keeping people shopping locally, I think, is one of the other big issues that faces Easton.
I'd like to ditto Megan, particularly on the growth issue. When I campaigned and knocked on doors, there were two primary complaints that people had. Number one, traffic was a problem, that the rate of growth had exceeded the ability of the town to provide adequate infrastructure to keep traffic at a reasonable level. And number two, there was a growing sense of a disconnect between what was happening in the town and the people. People said, I don't understand why developments are sprouting up. I don't understand why this is happening or that is happening. And I would say, well, have you been reading the newspaper? And they would say, well, I just don't have time. People in my ward are working class people, often working more than one job. And so one of the things that I noticed was that people did not have the time to pay attention to what was happening, to read the newspaper, and to stay involved in what was happening. So I decided to make an effort to reach out to those people and communicate with those people to help engage them in the process, because people felt disengaged. Very angry and upset at the growth and the problems that resulted, and feeling very helpless and hopeless about what to do about that. So after I was elected, I decided my first priority would be to engage the community and reach out to them in a way that was easier than, you know, relying on the newspaper for communication. So I've developed email distribution groups. I have a Facebook page for one of the projects that I'm working on with the town. And I do as much as I can to provide opportunities for the public to learn about what's happening. I started having quarterly Ward 1, I call them gatherings, really town meetings. Unfortunately, I haven't had one for 6 months, but I do intend to have one again in January, and typically those meetings are in the fire hall. I advertise them in the paper. I use my email distribution group. I send out flyers, and it's a wonderful way to keep people informed and engaged.
When you said that, why are developments sprouting up? I mean, that seems to me to be an interesting question for people to ask. What about that? I mean, what about where you see this going in terms of the power of developers' dollars? How do you see that playing out?
We have a comprehensive plan that our planning and zoning department develops, and it takes years. They engage in this process with the community through meetings, charrettes, question and answers, online surveys, open meetings. And it took them 2.5 years or so to write this comprehensive plan that is the vision of how Easton's going to develop in the next 6 years. And so one of the ways that we've dealt with it is we have – now, this is, remember, just a guideline. It's not set in stone, but it's not a law. We have set up a vision of Easton and where we're going to annex land and when that land is going to be available. Some kind of timeline, which I think helps to us to restrict the amount of growth that we have. We have stated in the comprehensive plan that we would prefer to see a 1% growth rate rather than a 3% growth rate. So we as a community understand that, and this is what the people have said they've wanted. And so we put it in the comprehensive plan, and it's something that we try to follow as a council when we're reviewing projects.
I would, you know, Megan just did a very nice job in giving the context in which we make decisions regarding new development. I would like to say that one of my observations as a relative newbie to this political arena is in learning more about how development happens. And one of the things that a developer will do is engage the town in a conversation about various amenities that they could provide to the town and pay for. that can be very, very, very appealing, almost seductive, I think. And in a time when, fiscally, everybody is tightening their belts and tightening and tightening and tightening, I think it can be very alluring to look at other things that a developer may say that they will do for the town, such as put in sidewalks or put in a nice park or improve this intersection, as well as in Easton, we 6 years ago began collecting impact fee money from developers to help address the impact of development. But I think it is easy for possibly town officials. I don't know what happened in Berlin, and I don't want to suggest that this is what happened in Berlin, but sitting from where I sit, knowing that we want more pedestrian access, we want sidewalks, we want parks, we don't have the money to do all that we need, and for a developer to offer to pay for those sometimes can be very seductive.
So what do you do about the seduction?
Well, since I started that conversation, Megan, would you like for me to? I try to, number one, recognize that carrots are being dangled, and I don't necessarily have to bite. And I try to remember, I feel very strongly that we need to adhere to a slower growth rate, and that we need to have extremely high standards for new growth coming in, and timing is everything. So I think the developers that have been working with the town of Easton, of course, are talking with the town staff, reading the comp plan, getting a sense of how our standards are changing, and are trying to bring plans to the Planning Commission for review that match the town's comprehensive plan and standards for growth. One of the things that I challenge myself to do, and a good example would be the Lakelands development, Phase C, which we most recently voted on, and unfortunately, and Megan and I were on opposite sides of this.
Why?
On a 3-2 vote, the town did approve a PUD amendment for Lakelands Community off of Route 50.
To build?
It was already a pre-approved development. Originally, the plan was for 29 single-family units. The economy tanked. The developer was losing money. This is a very general summary, and was needed to figure out a way to save money because he was losing money, and so the PUD amendment created a high density that I felt was unacceptable. With only one way in and out of Route 50. And really on that alone, I decided not to vote and approve that development. Additionally, the Phase A and B aspects of that development, I felt, although the development was billed as luxury townhomes, and I just didn't see that the developer had really brought to the table what the town had originally envisioned.
So. How did you see that?
Sorry, Megan.
That's all right. I voted in favor of the bonus in density. The reason is because, as Kelly had said, Phase 1 and Phase 2 were already built, and the people in the community had issues with how it was built. There was the pool was too small. There wasn't enough parking on the streets. And I felt that this was an opportunity. They already were allowed to build a certain number of townhomes, and they were just asking to add an additional one. And I felt that the density bonus, the amenities that came along with that were worth, having that to be allowed because they already were building on a cul-de-sac. We made that a through street, got rid of the cul-de-sac. We added a park. For that development, we added a walking path, we added extra parking in the front, we added a larger pool space. So I felt that some of the issues that the people already living in the community were dealing with were able to be addressed by adding in the bonus.
So I wonder, not to reopen this discussion, but to talk about that question of how communities like this survive and grow. I mean, if in Maryland, where you have local property taxes are what fuel the coffers of a town. Mm-hmm. And so property values, if you don't have enough property to tax, then you don't have enough income coming in, which is a way for saying that we have to have more growth to have those taxes. But then that also means more roads, more schools, more.
Sure. It's actually, I think it's I know, it's a myth that new development will pay for itself. There are many people think that in order for a town to grow and to increase its coffers, we need to do that on the backs of the developers. And that is absolutely not true. I've forgotten the exact statistic, but for a home that is built that is valued over $250,000, the town actually ends up paying for something like a 25%, and I'm not remembering this statistic or this percentage accurately, but there are formulas out there that can calculate the amount of money a town must pay to support new development, and it does not favor our side when you look at expansive development. So, I think we need to look at other sources of revenue, and that's a question that's bigger.
And what would they be
for me right now? That would be the follow-up question.
What would be the ways that you would create an economy without that kind of development for a community like this?
I do not know. I do not know. It's a question that needs to be answered, and we need to look at that.
This is the 300th anniversary of Easton, right? I mean, I think that America is a very young place. You know, you go to places like Istanbul, and you're standing in some place that was been standing there since the year 800. But 300 years old in America is a very old place, and there are people and families who have lived here that long. I mean, whose roots go back to the beginnings of this place, and there are a lot of issues that came out of that. And one of the things you said earlier, Megan, was that the district you represent is largely African American and Latino, right? And I would take it there's no African American representation on the council at the moment. Or am I right or wrong about that?
After my election, there has not been.
After your election. So what about that divide in places like Easton? I mean, this goes back a long way on the Eastern Shore and all through Delmarva. I mean, it's, when you look across a little further over on the shore in Somerset, the first commissioner who's African-American was elected after, even though 42% of the population is African-American, they've never had an elected official, nor public officials, nor administrative officials who are African-American. The DOJ is investigating the last election in Crisfield to see if there were violations of voting rights. So that history does exist. So how do you all view that in terms of both the growth in the future of Easton and in your community and the divide or bridges that exist between communities here?
A large percentage of my district is rental units. And so I think one of the things that is of concern to me is keeping affordable housing prices low. Mm-hmm. I sit on into the meetings of the Affordable Housing Board that we have, which addresses a lot of the issues pertaining to my ward, and keeping rentals safe and, like I said, building affordable, safe housing. And that's one of the problems with sometimes with the infill is they're coming into neighborhoods or taking over some of the some of the existing buildings, renovating them, and the cost isn't in a range that allows the people who have been there to continue to live there. And that's one of the big issues with my ward, for example. And each ward is different. Kelly has mentioned issues pertaining to her ward. We're each a representative for a different kind of population in our community. Hmm. And that's one of the big issues with my ward is, affordable housing and safe rentals. And so trying to keep a safe community, a safe neighborhood where those residents who've been there for a long time. In my neighborhood, I have two historic African-American churches right around the corner. So keeping those neighborhoods viable yet keeping them safe is kind of a little bit of a juggling act, that has to happen.
So how do we do things like that, though? I mean, this is, I mean, you described your district as a working class district. So you both represent not the most affluent communities on the shore, and probably people who have whose roots go back a long way in this place.
I moved here in 1982, and that was many, many years ago. And one of the first things that I noticed when I moved here from New York was the huge discrepancy between the rich and the poor. I really see that we need to work on providing more jobs to support a middle class. We need to attract a middle class. The Eastern Shore certainly has a very long history, a troubled history of race relations. And I've seen huge growth in that area, especially in the last several years. We're growing a middle class. It seems to be more opportunity for African Americans moving in. And I see a lot of healing happening, and that's a good thing.
You see a lot of healing happening.
I do.
How do you see that?
Well, I think the celebration of our 300th was a perfect example.
Yes.
Our kickoff was a gospel extravaganza at the Avalon Theater, which I attended, and it was a beautiful thing to see people, whites and blacks, celebrating our town in the Avalon, seated next to each other, celebrating together, and it was a beautiful thing.
There's one other thing. Frederick Douglass, for example, was a big, had a big impact on our community. He lived, he was enslaved here. He came back as a free man. The community is erecting a statue on the county courthouse lawn. And so I think this is a way of celebrating a person in history, regardless of your race. And it's something that the whole community has been able to get together around. We've got a great group that's working. The Honor Society has been working hard, and they're looking to unveil the statue in this spring. And so, again, it's something that crosses race. The issue is doing the right thing. He needs to be honored. He deserves a statue. And so we as a community, regardless of race, again, are working towards getting that done. I think that's another example.
I'm curious, in this last election we just had, O'Malley and Ehrlich and the elections we had here on the shore, and a lot of new people came in different elections all across Delmarva. And you see the huge crunch that the state budget is in. How does this affect Easton? How does it affect, you think, where we are, we are going as communities?
It affects us tremendously. I do have to say that one of the things that I appreciate so much, given the bipartisanship and the hostile environment almost between Republicans and Democrats on a state and a national level, we don't have that on a local level. We are able to, work with Republicans, Democrats, Independents. It's all about the issue. It's all about the right thing. What is the right thing to do, and how can we work together to make that happen? So I really, with all of the what I call insanity happening around us, where people have lost the mission due to bipartisan wrangling. I really find comfort in our ability on a local level to work together, and recently have thought, how can we take what we do and somehow seed it into the state or national level? I don't know, but what we do here works and works well.
How do you think what's in the state now is going to affect this place?
Financially, it's affecting us because our highway user fund has been, last year it was significantly impacted, 90% we lost, which is a large percent, a large part of our operating budget. I expect in the next few years, it to be down to zero almost. So that financial impact from the state aid, to our community is significant. It's we need to come up with ways of getting through these difficult times, not relying on aid from the state. because it's just I just don't envision it being there for the next few years.
The other important economic factor is looking at teacher pensions. And it's a good example of how a change on the state level trickles down. If teacher pensions are directed to the county, that burden absorbed by the county will have a huge impact on the municipalities within the county.
And could you get money from the counties?
Absolutely.
As well?
We get support and help from the counties. So I've been watching that closely and crossing my fingers.
Well, this has been great.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about our town. And for all those listening, come out and visit us. We're more than just any town USA. Come on off of Route 50 and visit our historic downtown.
You're listening to On Delmarva on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we'll be right back with Reverend Craig Mathias, the newly elected county commissioner from Somerset County. This is Mark Steiner, and welcome to another part of our program, On Delmarva. We are about to have a conversation with the Reverend Craig Mathias, Sr. of Princess Anne County, Princess Anne, Maryland, excuse me. He is the first African-American in 344 years to be elected to a countywide office in Somerset County. And Reverend Craig Mathias, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So this has been, I've really found both this kind of social political sojourn in Somerset County and your own as very interesting.
Uh-huh.
But let's start with the political before we turn to some of the personal, though they're all, often in our lives it's hard to not to intertwine the two. Mm-hmm. Talk a bit about what this election, your election to the Somerset County Board of Commissioners, says to you and what it says to, you think, the county at large and to our state?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, political office is not something that I endeavored to pursue, but there were individuals who asked me to run. And after much prayer and thoughtfulness, I finally consented to do so. And even so, when I did consent to do so, it was reluctantly. But, you know, I just felt that if it was in the will of God for me to be in that position, any way he could use me to do so, it would happen. And that's what occurred. I told some individuals, I said, well, you know, I really didn't campaign hard, but there were individuals who, you know, spoke on my behalf, I guess you could say, and worked hard to get people to know, perhaps if they didn't know who I was, to make them aware of whom I was. And I believe that this opportunity has opened doors for many. And I guess my biggest concern would be for the younger people of the community, because Somerset County seems to portray, or a lot of young people, I should say, seem to have a negative view of the county in regards to once they graduate from high school to be able to secure jobs. The economic status in Somerset County is not really that great. And if you pursue education or continue to improve, you know, education through the county, if you go to UMES or any other college and you want to come back to Somerset County, it's limited in the jobs that are available. So many of our youth that pursue higher education, after they do so, they leave. So you're not getting them to invest back into the county in which they have grown. But I think this opportunity will open the door for some other individuals, because if you go in the county offices, mm-hmm. you don't see any African-Americans, or really you don't see any minorities. So, you know, it doesn't just affect African-Americans. It affects all minorities. And I think this is a great opportunity for the negative image of Somerset County to be corrected in some degree, as far as people from the outside looking in, and even from those on the inside trying to look out, that this would give them a ray of hope.
Let me take a step. You said so much there. Let me kind of parse this out, and let's talk a bit about history, your own and the county's. But when you said you walk into the county government offices of Somerset County and all the faces of work there at the moment are white and have probably known each other for a long time, is my guess. So you, as the first African-American county commissioner, I mean, there's a huge weight on your shoulders in many ways. What how do you change that particular part of it, just that? Just the fact that there are no faces of African-American in that office. There are no black people who are in positions of professional importance inside the administration. How do you begin to address that?
Well, you know, sometimes people are not aware of things, or sometimes they just don't care to change things. I think this is an opportunity for me to at least make them aware that every culture, every organization should experience diversity, because it brings in the opportunity for new thoughts, new ideas, and even new perceptions. You know, we're living in the year 2010, and there are qualified African-Americans, Hispanics, Asians, and other minorities that are well able to perform any job task that's required in this county.
So, I mean, when you are – the relationship you have to build in something – I actually misspoke a moment ago when I said, what are you going to do about it? Because this is not on you. I mean, this is a countywide issue, but you're representing the interests of African-Americans whose interests – and the interests of minorities in general and of change in racial harmony have really not been represented for a long, long time.
Correct.
So that's what I meant by that. Not that it's
not a long, long time. Never.
No. I stand corrected.
No problem.
So I wonder, though, what do you think the process is there? I mean, I was in Chestertown about a month ago meeting with the mayor and some folks from the African-American community and others in that town. Mm-hmm. And I remember, those many years ago when I was a kid, and we went down as Freedom Riders to Chestertown. Mm-hmm. But in that town, what they're trying to do now is almost akin to a truth and reconciliation work that happened in South Africa to heal some of the divide and the wounds in those communities. What do you think it takes to begin to heal the divide and make Somerset whole?
Well, for one thing, you know, being a pastor, I have to refer to the Bible.
You're a Zion Baptist Church in Cambridge, right?
Yes.
Yes.
But, you know, first of all, it's Word of God tells us if we confess our sins, He's faithful and just to forgive us and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. The first thing in overcoming anything is you have to communicate the fact and acknowledge the fact that it first existed. And one of the things that I find in this county is you have so many people that don't want to talk about it, and not just in this county, but even in this country.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to talk about diversity and racial injustices. You know, we can't change what happened. We're not fortunate enough to be able to go back and change time. But you can change the lack of communication between ethnic groups. And once you really realize that if you would be fair, open-minded, and honest with all people, basically all people are the same. You know, they want basically the same things. They really would like the possibility of having equal opportunity to whatever endeavor they're trying to accomplish. So if people would be open and honest and say, yes, it happened, but what can we do to improve our relationship, or what can we do to improve my perception of you? And if you really think about it, Mark, this country and as a whole basically portrays certain ethnicities in a certain light. One of the things that if you only thing you do is listen to the news and you don't interact with other ethnicities, for example, this country plays a major role in the perception of African-American males. If you didn't know any better, you would think every black male was on drugs, had some female pregnant, didn't have a job, did not pursue a quality education, and was on welfare. I mean, that's the image that this country paints of a lot of African-American males. But you have a large number that are pursuing great jobs and a quality education. So a lot of times people's perception is the only reality that they know.
That's true. I suppose when I was reading and following up with people and talking to people down there, and we've been covering issues in Somerset County for a long time, since the ACLU first brought its suits there that you were involved mm-hmm. with 17 years ago in 1993, that when the Task Force on Diversity that was established and had that community meeting last year in June, mm-hmm. Does something come out of that? Is that a place where that can continue, that can begin a process of an open dialogue between communities? Or is it going to take something different and special to make that happen?
You know, I believe it was a very good starting point, and some positive things have occurred as a result of that. But I don't believe there's enough dialogue, mm-hmm. between those in power and those who are seeking equal opportunity. And once again, if there is not continual conversation between different ethnic groups, then therefore you can never really establish a good relationship. Because if you try to sweep it under the rug and keep things the same, then nothing ever really changes.
So to continue that idea, in 1993 when the lawsuit was brought that you were part of, because people who didn't live in the county back then could mm-hmm. land, if you own land, you could vote, you could still vote even if you lived in California.
Right. Well, if you had a business in the city limits,
right,
but lived outside of that jurisdiction, you were still eligible to vote, which is ludicrous, but that's the way it was. But these individuals basically were so outraged that they were even talking about dissolving the city charter
and closing the
county
because
they didn't want change. They were reluctant to change. And if you look at the motto of the county, "Separatum," well, always the same.
Always the same.
That's right.
Things aren't always the same.
No, they're not. And whether you want to or not, things will change with or without you.
So what is – a couple of good thoughts. I mean, because I'm just very curious. What has been your interaction since your election with your fellow members of the Board of Commissioners?
It's been well so far. We've only really had two official meetings, but they seem to be a pretty decent group of guys, and they're easy to talk to. But you know how that goes. I mean, things are not always the way they appear. People a lot of times will try to put on a good air and a good front, but I do believe that basically they are good guys. And matter of fact, one in particular, two or three in particular, well, really all of them, I should say, seem to be very open-minded and that you should be able to talk to in a reasonable manner. And I think we'll work well together.
So what do you think will be the paramount issues that you're going to raise on the Board of County Commissioners that will test and see how far this dialogue can go and can begin to change things?
Well, for one thing, they have established an EEOC committee, which will review complaints and so forth from if there's discrimination or unfair treatment. That's been implemented. So now they will sort of have someone who's responsible for what people perceive as any type of injustice. And, of course, they report to the commissioners. And so they're like, I guess you could say, sort of like a mediator, being able to hear and express the concerns of citizens in the community and those on the workforces of the county.
Will there be a change in the district outlining the districts in this new decade?
Yes, and that's probably so because you know they did this, the new census, and I'm sure at some point in the near future they will be looking to redraw the district lines. Now, how that will affect myself, I don't know. Being as though I am supposedly the representative of the minority district, but we'll see. Only time will tell.
Only time will tell. And that'd be interesting to see. I'm very curious, as you are, I'm sure, to see how the political process develops and works.
Yes. It should be very interesting.
It would be fascinating to watch. And I think very important also.
Correct. Because, you know, currently, now when they did the first district, ECI was included.
Which is
of course, you know, the person just can't vote. But you had a prison population of over 3,000. Also, the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, part of that was included. But what they did was they split the campus almost in half so that it wouldn't give, you know, that population the opportunity to carry, basically, per se, an election.
Which would divide the potential African-American vote because these young people
Correct.
Who go to college may, in fact, which is a large African-American institution, may, in fact, vote in a local election since they live
Correct.
There while they're going to school there.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a lot to address here. I mean, you know, that you are the first person to be elected or appointed to a top job in the county,
mm-hmm.
period, in the history of the county, it was kind of shocking that only one African American has been hired by Somerset County in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
But a small percentage of all the people who were hired, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot there that has to be wrestled with.
Yes.
And I, you know, your own sojourn into this. I mean, it's interesting. I just so that our listeners and people know around the peninsula and also around the state who may be hearing your name for the first time, Reverend Craig Mathis, the first African American elected in the 344-year history of Somerset County to a countywide office. And this has been a long struggle by the NAACP in that county, Kirkland Hall, Craig Mathis, and many others who have been fighting for justice and social change in that county. But your own sojourn, I mean, your family is from Somerset.
Yes.
But you were a little kid in Philadelphia and you moved back here with your mother.
Yes. Yes, and my mother taught in Somerset County Public Schools for 40 years.
And your wife is a school teacher as well.
Yes, in Somerset County also. I think she has almost 30 years.
Wow. And that's another history that we talked about in an earlier show about Somerset County, that it wasn't even until 1969 that the schools were integrated.
Correct, and they didn't do it willingly then.
And that was 15 years after Brown v. Board.
Correct. Yes, indeed.
So,
once again, reluctant to change.
Well, tell me what you think the reluctance is about.
Well, you know for yourself, usually those who are in power are always reluctant to relinquish any hold that they have on power. And so when you control something, usually you don't want to let it go. You want to, as long as it remains the same, then you know you have that authority over it. But when change occurs, it sometimes loosens the grip of the authority that you have and the influence that you have on that particular item or area. So if there is no change, then I'm at the top, then I don't have to worry about being second or third.
Yeah.
And those who have been at the top of the food chain have not been willing to change that. Realistically, when you look at the history of the county, this county economically has been a poor county for years. But in the 50s, you had General Motors who was looking to come in to Somerset County. You had DuPont who was looking to come into Somerset County. But those who were in power didn't want them here because it would have minimized the cheap labor that they had in the county.
And the notion of cheap labor, not completely, but many of those who are in that workforce, African Americans, still exists.
Correct. Correct. Because at that time, you did not have the, you know, those of Hispanic descent residing in the area like you do now. So it was basically the cheap labor of African Americans.
When you look at the history of the county and look at where you are now and what's going on, a friend, dear friend of mine who's been on this program numerous times, Sherilyn Eiffel, wrote the book on the courthouse law and confronting the legacy of lynching in the 21st century. And the book was about the lynching of George Armwood in 1933, the last man lynched in Maryland in Somerset County. And when she talked to me about that, she also talked about the reluctance of people who – she knew either witnesses it, children, or knew about it to even talk about it or deal with it or address it. Now,
right.
How much of that kind of thing plays into what goes on now? That legacy, how much of that still is part of what the subtext of everything that occurs, or is it not?
Well, silently it is, because, as I said, you have so many who either will not talk about it, will not admit it, or just try to sweep it under the rug. But once again, it happened. It is part of the history of this county. Many will not acknowledge the fact that their parents or grandparents participated in it, or they knew something about it, or they saw it. But it happened. And there's nothing you can do to change what has happened. The best thing to do is acknowledge that perhaps maybe we were wrong, we made a mistake, and those that we may have mistreated, we apologize. But usually, and when it comes to problems with racial issues, those who have abused the abuser will not say to the person that's been abused that I apologize. And one thing about this country, what was it, maybe last year, year before last, secretly, they acknowledge or apologize for slavery, but you notice that it wasn't widely broadcasted in the news media.
I wonder why.
So this country has a history of being reluctant to apologize for the injustices that have been done to other people.
You clearly come across in these conversations as somebody who's very strong, very clear about what you think and see, but also you come across somebody, at least to me, from this our first real meeting, and not face-to-face, but our first real meeting here, as someone really open to everybody in Somerset County.
Correct. You know, one of the things that I guess why I can relate to it so easily, because the community that I was raised, we were the only black family there. And so coming up, before my mother would allow me to take my bicycle and ride over a friend's house, the only kids I had to play with were white. And I didn't understand, of course, at that time, the significance of discrimination. But one of the kids, it was three boys that used to come to our house, and I used to go to their house to play baseball and so forth. And they would come over. My mother would fix food and lunch and everything for them. But one of them, whose mother originally was from Germany, got killed at 13. I think he was either 12 or 13. And the other two, I noticed, didn't come to my house as frequently. But now the other two, when I would go to their house, their mother was from the area. Their father seemed to be pretty good. The mother, you know, she tolerated me. You know what I'm saying? And like I said, I knew something was different, but I didn't understand it at that time. But because the guy that was killed, because he was no longer there to influence the others, then the relationship that I thought I had with them diminished, because they were basically dealing with me because of the other guy. But once he died, like I said, that friendship deteriorated. You know, so that taught me a very valuable lesson. And, you know, that you never judge everyone by one person. How, if a person mistreats you, you do not take it out on everyone of that persuasion. you treat people the way you want to be treated. And as long as you do that, then I believe things will work out for the good regardless.
Well, that's an interesting story, a very powerful story, and it's interesting that that's one you're going to carry with you on the Board of Commissioners in terms of what fuels your work.
Correct. Because I represent not just African Americans, I represent everyone in that district and the county.
And it's a mixed district.
That's correct.
And a mixed county.
Correct.
So tell me what your top three priorities, or not three, what are your top priorities as you enter your first term on the Board of Commissioners of Somerset County?
Well, for one thing, to stress to young people in general, but especially to African Americans, the importance of a quality education. And also, everyone is not college material, but you can acquire a skill. So these young people need to understand that walking out of school is not going to help you any, it's going to hurt you. And, you know, a lot of times when you're young, you can't understand things, and you can't see the future because you're only thinking about the now. But they have to understand that to get a decent job, you have to have a quality education or a technical skill. So that is one of the priorities that I would emphasize, you know, throughout the county, is this, the importance of getting a quality education for all of our youth. And the other aspect of that is we have to get parents involved. When I was a kid, and most, I can speak for most black families, they instilled in their children the necessity of having a quality education. Well, that's not happening as strongly as it used to. So we need to revert back to that, you know, teaching our kids how important it is to get a good education. And also economic development, trying to find a way for companies to come into Somerset County. But once again, without people who possess a good education and technical skills, a lot of manufacturers will not locate in an area where there are unqualified individuals to perform the job responsibilities that they need. So that's another factor in why you have to have a good education and technical skills.
In terms of what faces Somerset County, what do you think are the major issues, the major questions that Somerset County as a whole has to resolve that you want to push forward as a county commissioner?
Once again, education,
mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that this district lacks is when you look at the makeup of the students and you look at the number of minority teachers, it's really nowhere close. So there has to be an emphasis put on in getting minority teachers in our public schools. Economic development, getting companies and businesses to relocate into this area. And then, of course, giving people hope. And when I say that, I'm referring to the idea of letting our young people know that if you do what's required of you in getting a good education and or job or technical skills training, that you will have equal access to any available jobs.
This has been a fascinating conversation, and I look forward to following with all of our listeners and the rest of this Delmarva Peninsula and our state what happens as you, Reverend Craig Mathias, Sr., take this new job as County Commissioner for Somerset County and see where this takes us all.
Well, thank you very much, sir, and I'm humbled that you thought enough of us to allow us to be a participant in your show, and I certainly do appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too, and I'll look forward to meeting you in Somerset County.
All right, sir. Take care.
You too. That was the Reverend Craig Mathias, newly elected County Commissioner from Somerset County. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.